Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, my name is Patricia Martins Marcos, and you are listening to New Books in Science and Technology Studies, a channel with the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Professor Greta Lafleur about her new book, The Natural History of Sexuality in America, out by Johns Hopkins Press. And Professor Lafleur is Associate Professor of American Studies, and she is also Director of Graduate Studies in the program in Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Yale University. The Natural History of Sexuality in America is an excellent and I think extremely rich book that comes with a very beautiful Walton Ford cover that I think will really speak to a very vast and versatile audience, from scholars of race and sexuality to those interested in science studies, gender and sexuality, queer studies, as well as histories of the body and colonialism more broadly. This book has a little bit of everything for everyone. As a historian of the body and of science myself, who works on the 18th century, this book definitely had a lot for me. And I think it very effectively historicizes categories that we often take for granted, like sex, race, vice, or habit, and shows us not only their temporal contingency, but by inviting us to delve into the strangeness of early modern ontologies and epistemologies, it ultimately creates the possibility of different futures as well. These are futures of greater intersectional solidarity in which we are invited to think about the collective and move past the dominance of the individual, the subjective, and the biopoliticized body. Professor Lafleur, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for writing this book.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. And I just want to offer a really quick, kind of pedantic, but I think still important correction to what you just said, which is just that my book, the title is The Natural History of Sexuality in Early America. Just because right. I just don't want people in, expecting, broadly American to be disappointed or surprised by the 18th century content.
That's right. But it's in early America. That is the title, the full title.
Yeah.
If you wouldn't mind, the first question, as it is usual in the channel, is about you and mm-hmm. how you came into this field, into this specific project. And additionally, I always think it's very interesting to hear about the process of transforming the dissertation into a book.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a long one. I guess the way that I became an early Americanist, just a quick little anecdote about that is I had actually thought that I had wanted to be a medievalist. And so I started a master's degree at the University of Toronto, which is a sort of medieval studies hotspot, thinking that that would be the kind of work that I would be doing. Realized pretty quickly with people asking me questions like, so how good is your Latin? And like how well do you know Old Icelandic? That I was probably not really cut out for it. So I ended up taking a bunch of classes in 19th century American studies, early American studies, sexuality studies. And that really kind of solidified the field, my decision about what field I would end up in. And initially when this started, fast forward at this point to, I think at this point it was like five years later, 6 years later, when I was beginning my dissertation, I initially thought this was going to be kind of a history of psychology project because, you know, the book did grow out of the dissertation. Although, as I kind of mentioned earlier, the book pretty much is entirely rewritten. I think there's about 20 pages in the book that have any overlap with the dissertation, although a lot of the sources are the same and a lot of the questions are the same, but the answer is very different. So yeah, it started as a history of psychology project, and it kind of started as a revolution to civil war project, where I wanted to kind of ask questions about the emergence of a, like, the idea. It was kind of an intellectual history of interiority, an intellectual history of how people came to think about themselves as having an inside. And part of it was kind of motivated by the reading that I had been doing in some of Foucault's work, and but also a lot of, you know, early 19th century work on the history of psychology. So Benjamin Rush, John Haslam, writers like that. And you know, I kept coming over and over again to discussions of desire and inclination. And in this interesting way, it sort of... the more I looked at those primary sources, the more I ended up thinking about sex and sexuality. And, you know, I'd always been interested in those questions. You know, I did a graduate certificate in women, gender, and sexuality studies. I'm still, you know, I while I'm not appointed in women, gender, and sexuality studies in my current job at Yale, I nonetheless, you know, I was the director of graduate studies for WGSS this year. So, you know, these questions of about like that are sort of central to queer studies, feminist studies, have always been really central to me. But yeah, so I had been really inspired by reading a lot of Foucault, but I really thought it was going to be a history of psychology project. And the more I worked on it, the more I just found that all my sources were sort of like kind of constellated around discussions of sex. And that was how it became the project that it became. And so I started looking, I was like, well, okay, where did the sense, where did the idea of sexuality come from? You know, where did, you know, we toss this word around in such a glib, like, way that, you know, we all kind of assume that we know what we mean when we say it. And so I remember the dissertation really started when I was trying to find the first use of the word sexual in the sort of Atlantic print archive, the Anglophone Atlantic print archive. That meant the same thing that the word means for us today. And that was kind of where the book got kicked off, or where the dissertation got kicked off. And yeah, I mean, so that was kind of how it began. I guess I'll stop there. And if you want to ask further questions about it, I'll tell you.
So how was that process of confronting the need to entirely rewrite the whole thing and to use the same materials, but having to think about them and conceptualize them, perhaps frame them in a different way?
Well, I personally found it extremely freeing. I like to, this is mostly a joke what I'm about to say, but I always joke that I like to, especially as someone who, you know, teaches and works and lives in queer and trans studies, I like to divide the world into like neat binaries that I create myself. So, you know, some of the binaries that I create are like, people who prefer writing with pens versus people who prefer writing with pencils. people whose resting state is single versus people whose resting state is coupled. And so one of the other binaries are people who are revisers and people who are rewriters. And so I'm a rewriter. I'm getting better at revision, and it's sort of coming to me slowly as a skill. And of course you have to learn how to revise if you're going to turn a dissertation into a book, but I've always just been a rewriter, like throw it out, write it again. So it actually, in a way, I thought it was really freeing. And, you know, it really answered a quagmire that I was faced with when I was trying to revise a dissertation into a book, is because I kept, as I was trying to embark upon the project of revising it, I just found that none of my primary texts were supporting my argument. So I'd made this argument about the relationship between sex and interiority. In a way, I remember one of my dissertation advisors at the time sort of characterized my project as, oh, you're just doing like basically Foucault's history of sexuality, but like doing it for early America, doing it for the other side of the pond, and thinking about the specifically colonial subtext of these materials and like whether that changes that story or not. And so I was really thinking about the relationship between sex and desire and interiority. And the more I tried to sort of force that argument, the more it just didn't work. And I was really just hitting a wall. And then I spent a semester, I had a bunch of little research fellowships. So like I had a research fellowship at the John Carter Brown Library at Brown, and Mass Historical Society, a bunch of different archives. So I was spending like 2 months here, 2 months there. So I was able to take a semester off, a semester of leave from my job in order to do this research. In that time, I also had just torn my Achilles tendon. So I had just had surgery. And so I wasn't really able to go out and do very much. And I was just reading tons and tons and tons of critical theory at the same time. And I read Mel Chen's book, Animacies. And there was something about reading that book that really flipped for me the sort of set of questions that I had been asking about my archive. And I realized that my framing was not about, my set of questions were not sort of organized around the question of interiority, but actually around the question of exteriority, about like the influence of the external world and it wasn't that the book, I was applying the framework of the book to my book, but rather that reading that book allowed me to see what all these 18th century texts were saying about the way that sexual behavior was understood in that moment. And so many of them were using this kind of like environmental logic that really relied on a sort of analysis of external influence. So environment, the heat of the sun, climate, the relative quality of the air, food people were eating, governments that people were being governed by. Architecture they inhabited, their social milieu, they really understood these factors as bearing a really serious influence on sexual behavior. And once I sort of realized that, the book came together. It wasn't that it came together really quickly. It took me a long time to rewrite it. But it came together better. You know what I mean? Like it's right. in a way, you know, and it's funny because it made I was literally making the opposite argument that I made in my dissertation, but insofar as, you know, most opposites are related, it was sort of, it was like I had found the wrong text, but was making the wrong argument about them. So once I kind of found the right argument, it actually came together really organically and pretty quickly relative to sort of the struggling I'd been doing beforehand.
Wow, I think that's really interesting, that turn, that shift from interiority to the environment, mm-hmm. which is sort of what one of the protagonists of the book is really this notion of the environment and the outside world and of the body. So let's go a little bit into that.
Great.
And think more about humoralism, which you discuss with great detail, and this environmental idea of the body, this body that is porous and in constant dialogue with the external world. So this framework serves many purposes, and I think that to great effect, it really invites the reader to denaturalize our present-day common sense and knowledge categories about race, sexuality, and bodies more broadly, and how these are interlinked, in fact. Yeah. So in that sense, I think it would be extremely interesting to hear a little bit more about the importance of natural history on our narratives on the history of race and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And specifically about what you call the sexual politics of racialization.
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and also definitely the question at the center of the book. So I'll start with a little bit of framing about what was sort of on my mind as I was thinking about, as I was developing the project. So one of the things, once I started, well, let me just tell you actually how I got to natural history. So when I came back to the project and realized that I was actually thinking about environmental questions. So, you know, the main question of the book is, you know, how did people think about and make sense of sexual behavior, their own and that of people around them, in an era before the sort of emergence or, you know, onset or availability of modern vocabularies for sex and desire. So if we think today about sex as being something that we almost have like a property-like relationship to, or we imagine ourselves as having a kind of property relationship to, wherein our sexuality is something that is like lives in our body. It's sort of, unique to us. It's individuated. It's, it emanates from us. You know, it's not something we draw from the outside world. It you know, emerges organically from the sort of depths of our sort of bodies and psyches. And it also has this very specific geography. Like we imagine, for example, that our genitals, are sort of like hot spots of sexuality, whereas, for example, maybe our hands or our knees or something else, you know, aren't. So if that's the sort of modern sense of sexuality, and that, and also just to add one thing to that, which is that this modern sense also sort of stipulates that sexuality has a sort of expressive feature, you know, that it tells this kind of truth about ourselves and about our experience in a highly individuated way, which of course is Foucault's story about it. If that's the modern sense, and that was not available, you know, in the period that I'm looking at in the book, which is basically the late 1600s through the early 1900s, then how did people make sense of sex? And so one of the things that that I also realized when I was coming back to the book and doing revisions after I'd submitted the dissertation is that I'd realized I'd missed this major, major, major site for the explicit and consistent representation of sexual behavior, and that was natural historical texts. And I think I'd avoided them earlier. I certainly knew that they were there because, you know, I'd already had a chapter that sort of thought a lot about natural history in the dissertation. But I think I'd kind of avoided them because they are so racist. You know, I mean, they're ugly. You know, there's nothing. I mean, it's not that it's not that I don't think that there are things that are very interesting about natural history, but it's really hard to talk about the sexual or the story that they tell about sexuality, because it's a really ugly story. And it's basically the story of Atlantic, like, colonial racism. You know, it's right. it's sexuality and sexual behavior being weaponized in the service of articulating a kind of profundity of racial difference that is always being organized into a hierarchy where, you know, white people are at the top and everyone else is underneath right. them. Mm-hmm. So I just didn't really know what to, it's not that I didn't know what to do with that, or it's not that I didn't see it. I just sort of, I think I was just kind of being avoidant. Honestly, I was like, oh, I don't know what to do with this. and I was like, you know, I can tell this story about the relationship between sexuality and race differently. But then when I came back to it, I actually thought, you know what, if this is actually the place. And you know, I'd done a lot more reading when I was coming back to the dissertation to sort of start revising it into mm-hmm. a book. And I also realized that most historians of sexuality had not actually treated natural history. So at that point, something I had avoided was increasingly sort of appearing to me as kind of a huge intellectual gap too. And I thought, you know, all right, I have to actually deal with this archive. And yeah, and so, you know, these texts, you know, use... they use sexual behavior as evidence in, you know, because natural history was so concerned. I mean, I would say the primary concern of natural history, especially when it comes to humans, is understanding and articulating racial distinctions and what they call right. human yeah. variety. And so, you know, insofar as natural history is basically a story, it's race science, or it's like a, you know, it's the mm-hmm. The discipline in which race science was like kind of largely situated in the 18th century Atlantic and Anglophone world. You see people using the sexual behavior of, you know, you see Europeans using the sexual behavior or citing the sexual behavior of people from other parts of the world, not European parts of the world, of not white peoples, to sort of assert the sort of realness of the sort of difference between blackness and whiteness. And between Christianness and non-Christianness. And I think that one of the things I realized when I was looking at that archive is when I was trying to deal with the question of why hadn't historians of sexuality thought about this archive? Because it's right there. It is the most explicit and consistent site for the representation of sexual behavior that I've come across in 18th century print culture, Anglophone print culture. And I realized that my thesis about why people had sort of missed this or not dealt with it was in part because the understanding of the body at the center of natural historical inquiry is a really different vision of the body than the body that tends to be at the center of a lot of inquiries that are sort of developed by historians of sexuality. Historians of sexuality have often gone back to this period and kind of thought with the body that we kind of know today, which is like a closed system. I always think of Ed Cullen's book, which is on biopolitics, which is about sort of the way that, like, how bodies, it's called A Body Worth Defending is his book, and how bodies mm-hmm. sort of became understood as these kind of closed systems that needed to defend themselves from, you know, from the outside world. And, you know, he dates this to the advent of anatomical science and other types of human sciences that were, 19th century sciences. And so I felt like the historians of sexuality that I was sort of trying to build on, or whose work I was trying to build on, had actually brought that body to the 18th century, to their questions about the 18th century right. And mm-hmm. its history of sexuality. And so, you know, once I looked at the way that the body was understood in that moment, and you really, really, really see it in race science, which is an environmental body, a so-called quote unquote porous envelope, a body that's sort of eminently vulnerable to the sort of pressures of its environs of all kinds, you realize that like this is a changeable body, what Katie Childs calls a quote unquote transformable body. And, you know, and there's been so much great work in in the history of race on this. You know, I think about Kim Hall's work, which, you know, she was one of the very early influences on my work. Also Nussbaum too. And, you know, they really sort of center that, that humoral body, the body that sort of changes with intake and outtake. And once I sort of realized that that was the body at the center of these texts, I realized I needed to change my questions. And that was really how the project got it started. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's, that's, at least for me in my work is also very, it was a very important insight to come to that conclusion as well, that we are not talking about the same body. Bodies were very different and they were pliable, and understanding the effects, not only of the environment on them, but of how those environments were fundamentally racialized.
Yes.
So here I'd like you to sort of bring that racial element of the environment and of geography into this discussion about natural history and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, you talk about how writing about human variety in natural history rendered sexual behavior visible to 18th century inquiries about human difference.
Yeah.
You also mention at a certain point in I believe chapter one, that this rethinking of the body also constitutes an invitation for us to think about the sorts of archives that we have used and that we need to use in the future to cater to these stories. And I'd just like you to speak a bit more about this.
Yeah. So I think the other thing that I was sort of struggling with when I was trying to understand why historians of sexuality hadn't looked at these texts, the other thing that I sort of came to is that, you know, there have been wide and very legitimate criticisms of queer theory. And I think of queer theory as in many ways growing out of studies in the history of sexuality, like early works by Alan Bray, John Boswell, people like that. So the history of sexuality and queer theory more generally has been really critiqued for, or early versions of it was really critiqued, righteously so, I think, for its inattention to questions surrounding race, and specifically for its real just sole focus on whiteness and also on men. Like cis men. This has changed a lot since I started writing this project, but also, you know, early histories of race hadn't really thought as much about gender and sexuality. And so, you know, one of the things I was also trying to do in the book is kind of bring those intellectual genealogies together, not to force them, but to actually show people in my field in the 18th century and 18th century studies how deeply mutually imbricated they are, you know? And, I think I just lost the question. Sorry, will you remind me? I apologize. It's like 7
minutes. It was just about that coupling of race and sexuality and the racialization of space and geography.
And so a great example of this, and a really easy example that'll be familiar to like anyone who works or has read at all in the early modern period or 18th century, is thinking about the idea of the zones, right? The torrid zones, the temperate zones, and the frigid zones. So European geographers had kind of separated the earth, and this was like a kind of loose inheritance from Galenic and Hippocratic medicine, which is, you know, much older, ancient at this point. And they'd kind of separated the earth into three zones. So there's the torrid zones, which are the zones closest to the equator, and these are actually on maps, like people get very specific about where they are. I think the torrid zones are like from the Tropic of Capricorn to the Tropic of Cancer, I think. And then there's the temperate zones, which are kind of like the bands in the sort of like the middle bands of the sort of like the top of the globe and the bottom of the globe. And then there's the frigid zones, which are kind of the poles and their environs. And And there are these real stories, these like very like heavily racialized stories about these spaces that also kind of told these quiet sexual stories, stories about sexual behavior alongside them. So, and you know, there were stories about humor. So, you know, if you lived at the equator, you would likely be, and also I want to just bracket all of this by saying that if you look for any sort of consistency in 18th century natural historical stories,
right.
about these zones, like you will not find any. Katie Childs gave me this amazing advice when she read my manuscript when it was sort of, my book manuscript when it was, in progress. And she was like, she told me, she was like, Greta, you know, it really seems like you're trying to, find some sort of internal coherence in 18th century natural historical thought and specifically race science. And she's like, just stop trying. It is not there. And it was really like one of the best pieces of advice anyone could sort of give me. Because, you know, you have like 8 million people telling 8 million different stories really about.
Right.
And
it's a point you bring out quite often. And I personally found it very freeing because, yeah, consistency, incoherence is the story, I think.
It
more
is.
Than anything else.
And this is one of the big takeaways. I mean, just as a side note, from my work on, you know, like the 18th century, I mean, like our own moment, you know, if you asked 50 people to tell you, like, you know, to sort of characterize the sort of political climate of you know, the United States today, for example, you'd get 50 different answers, you know, and you might have answers that would clump in, you know, four or five different places, but you'd still have really different answers. And that was very much the same for the 18th century. One of the things that, so if you think about the torrid zones, to go back to the question about racialized environments, you know, if you think about the, you know, the torrid zones being, being places where you're going to, where the environment makes people more, more amative. So like kind of more lusty, it makes mm-hmm. them more hot tempered, it makes them more indolent because it's hot. So they don't want to move their bodies as much. And, you know, the frigid zones being places where people were supposedly less amative because, you know, it sort of chilled their humors. And so they weren't as passionate about their loved ones, whether it be, you know, like wives and husbands or partners or, you know, or children or friends. If you look at that, you know, those stories, there's really intense stories about race in those. And usually, the stories about the temperate, torrid, and frigid zones also came with a sort of story about skin color and hair texture and morphology. And they're also telling stories about sex, you know, they're like, and they use these, they use sort of stories about amativeness or lustiness or lack of lustiness or, you know, respect for women or lack of respect for women or despotism of, you know, in marriage. They use these sort of putative and largely completely made up characteristics to assert the sort of realness of the difference between these different zones, you know. And so not only do people sort of end up wearing the kind of patina of the zone that they're from, but then you also have the zones themselves taking on these kind of like literally these geographies taking on these kind of like racialized and sexualized characteristics, and that were understood to kind of, you know, bear a kind of influence on people who pass through them. So this is like, you think about, stories, for example, about plantation owners, for example, who, are European, they're say like a man from England moves to say Jamaica to open a plantation or to start a plantation. You know, there's real stories about this quote unquote degenerating quality of the climate there. You know, and also there's also stories about the degenerating quality of or qualities that inhere in living in, for example, a slave society. You know, that slavery degrades both people. You know, people who are both enslaved themselves and
right.
also people
mm-hmm.
who are using and reaping economic benefit from the unremunerated labor of enslaved people. So yeah, you know, so that's what I was kind of trying to point to too, because we tell these stories about race that kind of in a way, like these stories about sexuality are often sort of reliant on theories of the ways that we understand race today, right? Like we really understand race today in a kind of, I'm forgetting the word for it, but like a skin color based way, right? It's like there's like in mm-hmm. a like a chromatist kind of way. But it wasn't just of course there were chromatist ideas circulating in the 18th century, but there were also a lot of other stories too. And and I think paying attention to the, again, the humoral body at the center of a lot of these theories, and the way that that humor has also affected your racial constitution. You know, the Comte de Buffon very famously said that, like, that was someone who was Black who was born at the equator, could be moved to the North Pole, and in 10 generations, his family or, you know, his descendants would be white, and vice versa. You know, race was also understood as transformable.
Right. These bodies were always pliable and subject to transformation. And I think that's something that is it's really important to take into account. So sort of building on that idea of the geographies, second chapter juxtaposes that to this notion of the complexion of sodomy.
Yeah.
And so how sodomy becomes not only added to this geography, but also to Islamic identities and to that form of racialization in particular. How did you come to that, to these sources and to this particular conclusion?
Well, I'm trying to remember how it was that I ended up in that archive. That was one of the hardest chapters to write in the book. It was a hard dissertation chapter to write. It was the last dissertation chapter I wrote. And it was when I rewrote it, it was one of the most difficult chapters to rewrite, but actually it's one of the chapters that I'm sort of the happiest with now. So I think if I'm remembering correctly, I think I came to the materials at the center of that chapter because I was trying to figure out, where you see, well, actually, let me back up for 1 second, which is just to say that the other thing that my book is kind of concerned with is the way that natural historical theories of racial difference and sexual behavior and the way that they're kind of imbricated, which are typically understood to be quote unquote like high or elite ideas. You know, these are texts that had expensive bindings, that had very small print runs, that were really expensive, and you know, these are also on top of the costliness of these types of texts, we're also talking about a place and time, which is in the case of my book, British colonial North America, so the 18th century, where most people couldn't read, you know, so, or for most of the century, the majority of people couldn't read. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and one of the things I'm trying to sort of ask about in this book is like, well, did the ideas in these texts rather, like some of these ideas about racial difference and sexual diversity, did they circulate beyond the kind of immediate elite purview of these texts? And, you know, there's been a lot of work that sort of demonstrated that natural historical ideas about race did. And so with that, I was kind of like, you know, insofar as all these texts about race are also telling these stories about sex, I kind of suspected that also some of these ideas about sex were circulating as well in much less elite, kind of more like cheaply printed, like kind of salacious, sensational texts that were for like a broad range of readers, including elite readers, but also kind of just readers who were, you know, like I always tell my students that a lot of the texts that I look at in my in the book are the equivalent of like tabloids. You know, they were the equivalent of tabloid magazines in our own time. So I was looking for explicit discussions of sodomy, and I think that's, I'm pretty sure that that's where, how I ended up at some of those texts. And so I ended up talking about Barbary captivity narratives, which were stories of Christian sailors, usually from North America or from England, but certainly there was a tradition of Barbary captivity writing in France, and I think also Spain as well, who would, in the course of their voyages, because, you know, shipping was the big way that products were getting across the ocean at this point, or were getting from place to place, at least in the context of the colonial and metropolitan relationships, who would end up in the course of their trips across the ocean, getting taken captive by Barbary corsairs. So Barbary corsairs were effectively pirates who were employed by the city-states that kind of rimmed the coast of the northern coast of the African continent. So a lot of them sort of faced out into the Mediterranean, Tunis, Tripoli, Algiers, Saleh, places like that. And so these enormously powerful city-states, many of which had sort of ties to the Ottoman Empire, which in the moment was immensely powerful and sort of, you know, gaining power every day. And it was really scary for a lot of Western Europe. And so these Barbary corsairs would take the ships. So the ships themselves were incredibly valuable. They'd take the goods on the ship. So all the products that, say, England was having shipped back to sort of gird their economy, the corsairs would take. They'd take all the sailors, every Christian on board, they'd take captive, and they'd sell them on the sort of small but still sort of robust Islamic slave market, which sort of flourished in these city states. It was really different from the African slave market or the slave trade. In the case of Barbary corsairs, people could be freed, like people could be manumitted by basically paying ransom. But I'm always just sort of interested. I love the sort of history of these corsairs because it's just such an amazing model. You know, you had people sort of you had corsairs sacking towns in Ireland and New Brunswick. I mean, they were just like all over the ocean, and they were immensely good at what they did. Anyway, but one of the big fears that you see people express, and sailors, you know, actually were some of the most literate, in terms of the sailors had some of the highest literacy rates of the moment because, you know, they were like trapped on boats for years at a time and they had nothing better to do a lot of times. And so they would teach each other to read and write. We see all these sailors expressing fears of getting sodomized as if they're taken captive by Barbary corsairs and sold on this slave market. And of course, this taps into like a very old kind of like proto-Islamophobic association of Islam with sodomy that you see between like sort of Protestants who are kind of aiming their concern at Islam. But you also see, I mean, the sort of sodomy is kind of used as this insult that kind of just glosses some sort of like understanding of fundamental difference. It's also funny to say fundamental, right? Because, you know, it was a word in the 18th century that people would use to refer to the anus. So sodomy is fundamental, quite literally. But so you'd see, so, you know, you'd have Protestants calling Catholics sodomitical. I'm actually doing a little bit of work on that right now for my new project. You'd see people, Quakers were described as sodomitical. If Protestants didn't like someone, they often just sort of, impugned them by suggesting that they might be a sodomite. And so that was definitely true of the Islamic world. And interestingly, you know, one of the cool things about writing that chapter was I got to do a kind of dive into the history of that region written by, for example, historians of like Algeria, you know, and it was actually interesting that you know, sexual violence was also a tool of war in that period. So it's not that, you know, sodomizing never happened. It's just that the sort of association of sodomy with a particular religion, in this case, Islam, was not really the sort of real explanation for it. But you know, it's interesting because you see the sort of the way that sodomy also becomes geographical. The city of Sodom is a place in the Levant, you know, and you really see Christians in that era really sort of like drawing connections between people who lived in that region and who were thus largely also, you know, Muslim, and the sort of practice of Sodom or some practice of sodomy. And it's just, I don't know, it's another way that that environment and geography in particular gets racialized and sexualized.
Right. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it was. I think it was a very successful chapter. I think it presented that case really seamlessly, and it was very interesting to read. So moving on to the next chapter, I think the idea of habit takes particular prominence, and it's really important. And it's an analytic that you theorize in a very intentional manner. Mm-hmm. For the 18th century inhabitants of early America that you study, habit was a form of destiny in a way. So I wanted you to unpack a little bit more for us how habit was fed into early theories of criminality, and what was the role of sexuality and race vis-a-vis habit?
Yes. So habit is a really thick word. Chapter three was probably the hardest chapter to write. It just dogged me. And I really had this sense, even when I was writing the dissertation, that the habit chapter was the most important chapter, and I couldn't really tell why. And now I kind of understand why. And I think what the habit chapter, kind of showed me, is that as much as I'm telling a story about the external world, about the environmental world, and the way that that there's a kind of environmental logic that informs the way that people understand their behavior and specifically their sexual behavior, that there's always this kind of double edge of, there's like a weird like chicken and egg question about, like, you know, what came, is it the internal that's influencing the external, the external that's influencing the internal? And what I kind of realized in that chapter was that that people in the 18th century really understood, like, both the sort of internal and individual inclination alongside environmental influence to sort of do the work of shaping behavioral inclinations and many other things as well. But I think habit was also one of the things when I was writing the dissertation that really got me thinking about the external. Because habit was a really big concern for all sorts of figures in 18th century North America or 18th century colonial North America. So habit is a really big term in the race science of the day. Habit, you know, in the 18th century refers to both behavior. So, like, your actual routines, like what you're doing every day, how you're cooking, how you're setting up your house, stuff like that. But it also refers to what you wear, right? Your habit is we will still say that nuns have a habit, right? They have there's a specific uniform that a lot of nuns wear, and it is called their habit. So Valtrop very sort of succinctly says that habit refers to both custom and costume, and I think that's a nice way of thinking about habit. And you know, of course, dress was really important for the race science of the 18th century Atlantic world. It was a big indicator of where someone was from and also their relative level of quote unquote civilization. You'll have these kinds of tables. And I think I'm trying to remember whether I reproduced that one in my book or not. Where it's also funny when you write a book and you can't remember what images are in it. But at one point it was going to go in, and I don't know if it stayed, but where there's like a table. And Roxanne Wheeler also reproduces this in her book, and it says habits of the different peoples of the world. And it says, all right, here's like a Malagasy habit. Here's a European habit. Here's an American, meaning in the parlance of the day, like a Native American, habit. And it shows basically the same two figures over and over and over again, wearing different clothing. So, like, clothing becomes this really important racial marker for people.
Right.
So in that chapter, I'm thinking a lot about the way that habit shows up in execution narratives. And execution narratives were basically like the true crime of the day. So any listeners who like true crime, they would have really been into these in the 18th century. So they would generally sort of tell the story of someone who was condemned usually to death. I mean, almost exclusively to death for a crime. And they would tell the story of the crime itself. And often, you know, as the sort of 18th century progressed, less so in the beginning, but much more so at the end, they would offer this like little case study of the convicted person to sort of explain. It would be the sort of explanatory framework that like kind of offers a little story or like narrative for how the person became, became bad or became this person that would do this bad thing, which was usually, in the North American colonies, the only capital crimes were murder, rape, and treason. So, you know, they did something, if they're being executed under the auspices of official law. Because of course I'm not talking about, for example, lynching, like regular lynching. I guess this is state lynching. That's different. So there were only three things that people tended to be executed for. So they'd offer these little stories of like how people came to be the sort of like quote unquote like, you know, bad person that they were or criminal that they were. And a lot of these execution sermons, so sermons were given the morning of the execution, and, you know, executions were huge sort of like social events. You know, I think it's Cotton Mather, but it might have been Increase Mather. I'm mixing up father and son right now, but describes mm-hmm. having to climb over the shoulders of people in the people in the church, because the church was so packed, to get to the pulpit in order to give the execution sermon on one of the days he was giving a sermon. And, you know, people would buy accounts of the execution. I mean, it's pretty macabre today, and it's, you know, also to my mind is a really important sort of piece of the history of both like pro and anti-death penalty sort of movements mm-hmm. in the United States. So these were big sort of popular events, and they would get these sort of popular reports written after them, and people would read them and really sort of consume them. But usually there were stories about like early bad habits that were offered as these kind of explanatory vehicles through which the sort of bad behavior of the quote unquote criminal was explained. And so I look at a lot of different examples in that chapter, but in that chapter, I do think in particular about this one case of this person who was convicted for rape. And he was a black man named Joseph Mountain, who had never been enslaved, who had left for England for 20 years and come back to the United States, and was convicted of raping a white woman who, incidentally, he's one of the only cases I've ever seen where he contends through the end that he didn't do it. And I think, you know, just because of the sort of the like way, way, way overwrought and overdetermined racialization of like rape, especially when it involves a black man and a white woman in the United States and British North American colonies, I think we should take seriously the sort of question of, you know, whether he did it or not, and take seriously the question of his insistence that he didn't. But people will talk about, you know, the bad habits that people developed when they were young, that led to this, you know, that hardened them, that like sort of hardened their bodies to the positive influence of the world around them that could have reformed them. And, you know, actually my colleague Kyla Schuller wrote this book called The Biopolitics of Feeling, which thinks a lot about these questions of bodily plasticity. She works a little bit later. She works in the 18th mm-hmm. or the 19th century. So if people have interest in that, they should really go read her book. So habit is just this kind of interesting mediating force between the inside and the outside world. So if you develop good habits when you're young, they can really sort of like mold you, and they can be this almost like this like defense system against the moral incursions or amoral incursions of the outside world. Mm-hmm. But if you inhibit and, you know, develop bad habits when you're young, you know, even the best sets of influences can't protect you against the sort of ways that these bad habits will pop up. And I think it really just tells a story about the sort of the way that the tension between individual inclination and external influence mm-hmm. was sort of mediated in that moment.
Right. And I actually think that it's also the idea of habit can be very generative for people who are working with medical manuals, as is my case, mm-hmm. and with the case of the police and the institution of the police, and what kind of crimes is the police surveilling. I think that could be a really generative site for to take your theorization of vice and think through it. So in the next chapter, chapter 4, you speak about the case of Deborah Simpson, who also lived under a name, Robert Shurtleff.
Yes.
And you caution against the seduction of identification and speak rather of opacity. You also mentioned that botany was a sexual science, and you identified very crucially as a sexual science that allowed the naturalization of British settlement in North America in its transition from colony to nation. But also, it allows that those same framework of colonial knowledge allowed Deborah Sampson or Robert Shurtleff to be understood as a new natural wonder. I thought this was so interesting. I really wanted you to speak a little bit more about it.
Yeah. So just to give like a little setup here. So that chapter is about The Female Review, which is a book by Herman Mann, who basically wrote a fictionalized memoir of Deborah Sampson, who also lived as Robert Shurtleff, who had dressed as a man, and I'll put sort of quotes around that, but who had dressed as a man and enlisted in the Continental Army in the sort of latter part of the Revolutionary War, and who had gotten injured in the war, and who later made a claim for what was called an invalid's pension, which is basically veterans' pay. So Herman Mann wrote this fictionalized memoir of Deborah Sampson because Sampson was campaigning for this invalid's pension and had been denied it, and was trying to make a claim for it again. And Sampson actually got a bunch of people on her side, Philip Freneau, who's a big printer in New York, a bunch of kind of like people from the literary world were kind of supporting her cause. So Herman Mann wrote this book in order to kind of support the cause of Deborah Sampson, to kind of laud her and prop her up as this kind of like early patriot of the very new at that point republic. It's really interesting. It's actually, in my opinion, kind of a really terrible book. It's really boring. People always ask me if I want to teach it to my students, and I'm always like, no, I would never do that to them. But what's interesting about it, like what makes it a kind of bad book is what makes it an interesting book to me, which is about 3/4 of the book are about Sampson's. They're just kind of these long, descriptions of like the natural world, like the flora and fauna, the cosmos, and a lot of it just talks about Deborah Sampson's sort of education in nature. Sampson, interestingly, was born into a very poor family in central Massachusetts. Actually, my aunt lives less than 25 miles away from where Deborah Sampson was born, and was indentured out, as many, many children were in that moment, by mm-hmm. her parents to a wealthier family. She wasn't sent to school. She basically took the books that the kids in the family that she worked for would bring home, and she learned to read that way. She had a little bit of sort of instruction from people in her life, but nothing really formal. And so Mann kind of describes her as this natural genius, but who was really inspired by the sort of nature around her. And he also, in the same sort of vein, when he's both trying to sort of assert her natural genius in order to sort of make a case for, you know, the validity of her invalid's pension claim, but he's also kind of trying to apologize for her kind of socially and sexually aberrant behavior, because she dressed as a man and joined the Continental Army, which, you know, a lot of other women did the same thing. You know, one of the things you would get mm-hmm. in many places if you signed up for the Continental Army was basically an enlistment benefit. So it would be a small sum of money that you'd get. But, you know, if you think about the Revolutionary War, this is a moment where a lot of people were really broke. You know, it was a moment where poor people in particular were hit pretty hard. And a lot of people just wanted the cash, you know, so people would, you know, do whatever they needed to do, enlist and then desert. There's actually some evidence that Sampson initially enlisted and then didn't return, basically enlisted and then just took the money and ran, and then came back and did it again, dressed as a man both times. Interestingly, Sampson also lived as a man after the Revolutionary War as well, for maybe a year, possibly a little bit more, which is just kind of an interesting detail. And Sampson has been sort of taken up by both feminist historiography and also queer historiography and also trans historiography as a sort of figure who's sort of lauded by all of these camps. Actually, my favorite thing about Sampson is that Meryl Streep actually mentioned Sampson in a 2016 rally in support of Hillary Clinton. It's just sort of a funny, I know, I was like, it's just really, as someone who works on this historical period, I'm just like, no one else who's like a poor enlisted person who fought in these like basically no-name battles of the Revolutionary War, like nobody, we don't know any of those people's stories except for Deborah Sampson, because of the fact that right. She did this sort of gender non-normative thing. And so Mann's trying to say, you know, not only is she like, she's a real patriot, but he's also like, guys, she's not a freak. You know, other women did that and ended up being accused of being prostitutes mm-hmm. or, you know, sex workers. They ended up jailed, beaten. Like, it was not something that was like heroic in its time. It was something that was like embarrassing and like outside the pale or beyond the pale of sort of like socially acceptable behavior for really anyone. So, and you know, he also talks in this memoir about this sort of passionate, like romantic affair that Sampson has with this woman that the book, who just the book refers to as the Baltimore lady. So there's also a kind of has this sort of sapphic smack to it. It's kind of like this like lesbian like novel. And so in order to kind of apologize for this, Mann says things like, you know, it's not her fault. She was merely the product of new sensations and emotions that arose for the first time ever with the onset of the new nation. He basically attributes her sort of like the feeling that spurred her on and to act in these particular ways to like this kind of new nationalism. And he really asserts that nationalism as something that's kind of derived from the land itself. He literally calls her a product of quote unquote Columbia's soil. And you know, if you look at the sort of the discussion of the sort of flora and fauna, which in the book, which really echoes and draws from a lot of the sort of interest in popular interest in botany of its moment, which was like the sexual science of botany or a sexual science because the Linnaean system of botany identified plants based on the relative visibility or invisibility of their pistils and stamens. So this is why it was the sexual science, because it's sort of distinguished by between plants based on their sex organs. It would like, you know, botany was very controversial because of this sort of the sexualness of its science, but it really became this great metaphor for man when he was discussing Sampson. You know, he really sort of draws on the sort of natural variation, benign variation of the sort of North American like landscape to assert the sort of naturalness of, you know, he's like, she's a wonder of nature, an exception of nature, but she is still natural. He uses the word natural for all the time. And, you know, this is, of course, happening in the wake of rampant violence against Native people, wars with Native communities. You know, at that point, they were about 30 years away from, you know, systematized Indian removal on the East Coast. And he really kind of asserts Sampson's indigeneity, even as there's like episodes of the book where Sampson proves their manliness, like Sampson living at that point is shirtless, proves their manliness and their realness as a sort of patriot by killing a Native person. It's the only person we see Sampson kill in the book. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was kind of, you know, this is a little bit of a different thing, but when I was working, teaching in, when I was my first academic job was at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And one of the things I ran into there, like an idea that I sort of ran into there, was some skepticism about the use of the term transgender by non-binary and, you know, sort of broadly gender non-conforming people in Honolulu, who really understood transgender as a sort of neo-imperial ideology, that there was a way that like, that it was like, right. organized around the erasure of ways of thinking about being in a sort of non-binary gender position, in being a sort of middle gender, which exists in like a lot of sort of Native Hawaiian community organization. There's like middle genders that people can occupy, and people really I saw this talk where someone was writing about this film called Kumuhina, which I actually teach in my trans studies class every year. And it's about Kina Wongkalu, who's a community leader and politician in Honolulu. And it was just it was the first time I'd kind of encountered that idea, because, you know, like transness is sort of associated, at least in the sort of East Coast American cities that I was I'm coming out with or coming out of as the queer communities in particular as this thing mm-hmm. that we need to protect, as this gender experience that is like to this day, you know, largely under attack and that we need to sort of as queer people stand in solidarity with. But it was interesting to have this other perspective. And I was like, wow, I actually see the way that that works in this Deborah Sampson text, you know, which sounds silly, yeah. but it's really there, you know, like there's a way that, that Sampson and specifically Sampson's sort of gender, particularity, is being sort of asserted as this kind of like newly indigenous, like quote unquote species mm-hmm. of American experience, even as, and that simultaneously to, the sort of murder and, you know, like systematic, you know, genocide of Native people. And so it's just, you know, it's those two things are really ugly to look at side by side, but I think it's really important to look at them side by side.
Very, very rich, boring novel.
yeah, very rich, boring novel. Exactly.
From your account. So in the last chapter, and maybe maybe we can try an exercise of thinking about the last chapter together with the epilogue.
Sure.
In the last chapter, you center around the concept of vice and sort of the early sciences of sexuality and how those emerge. And you discuss cross-dressing narratives, but this time of young unmarried women who escape lives as sex workers. So prostitution really becomes a center of attention, not only to you, but especially to the reformers and public health officials who were interested in treating prostitutes as these discrete mm-hmm. Classes of population, whilst yes. at the same time, sexual behavior also becomes a more individuated and embodied experience that we sort of discussed mm-hmm. in the beginning. I think this dovetails so nicely with your epilogue. There's called Thinking Sex Without the Subject, because mm-hmm. we have this emergence of these discrete classes of population and even of individuals at a certain point, vis-a-vis the sort of the trouble with the subject that you describe all throughout the epilogue. So yeah. I sort of wanted you to engage a little bit in that exercise.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's a great tension to pull out, because I guess in a way I hadn't really seen it. So, I mean, what I'm sort of tracing in the fifth chapter, which is on anti-vice narratives. So these little cheaply printed adventure tales that sort of stage the story of these like sweet white women from the, you know, from the rural areas of, you know, the East Coast who move to cities looking for work, or sometimes they're seduced first. They're seduced by local libertines and then they move to cities because they're so ashamed and they don't want to embarrass their parents. And then they end up sex workers. I mean, this is a very familiar story. If anyone knows, oh man, why am I blanking on the very classic 18th century, you know, the oh no, it'll come to me. Oh wow. I can't believe I'm blanking on the name.
It always happens.
The Harlot's Progress, the Rake's Progress. Oh, I can't believe I'm blanking on the name. But anyway, so it's a very familiar story. You know, the sort of young, innocent comes from the country to the city and is immediately corrupted and descends into sort of sex work, illness and death. And, but what's interesting about these little adventure stories that do tell that story, is that they're a lot of them, and I look at this set that are all set in this area of Boston that people called quote unquote Negro Hill, which was actually did represent a really storied and very old mixed race neighborhood in Boston. It actually was the site of Boston's biggest Black community for a really long time, and there's actually I'm gonna mess up the title. It's like the Massachusetts African American History Museum. There's still an African American History Museum on Beacon Hill, because of the sort of the oldness of the sort of community that lived there, and, you know, since the very beginning of the Republic. So anyway, so it's set there, and you know this part of the city. It's this sort of space is heavily racialized. It's imagined as this place where there were you know, brothels and theaters and, you know, taverns, all these things that are understood to be sort of urban pollutants. And, you know, this was also the era where you see huge population booms in all of the East Coast cities, New York, Providence, Philadelphia, Boston. So people, you know, there's a kind of alarmism about urban vice in general. And so these places, these parts of the city, and so it's Negro Hill in Boston, Hardscrabble in Providence, Five Points in New York. There's all, every city has one or has several. And they tend to be areas where there is greater sort of contact between white people and non-white people. And this is obviously also something that's really stirring the sort of fears of like white reformers in this era. And so you know, you see these adventure stories that are kind of telling these like kind of fun, whimsical, exciting stories about these neighborhoods and also giving you kind of a salacious peephole into these neighborhoods. But then you also see reform organizations who are trying to do anti-vice organizing. So working against sex work and other types of like what they think of as sort of moral dissipation, using these like popular texts in order to like raise money. Like you see almost like verbatim repetition of the language from these adventure stories in reports of like the, you know, so like the Boston Female Society for Missionary Purposes, for example. And this is in the beginning of the 19th century. And what's interesting to me in that chapter is just the way that vice becomes a collective problem. And you see in turn, the like early municipal governments, like when Boston is incorporated as a city in the 1820s, you see early municipal governments relying on these missionary reports, which in turn have relied on and literally cited verbatim these adventure stories as these municipal governments sort of like develop early public health sort of campaigns. And one of the big things that they try to do is get rid of sex work and get rid of basically red light districts. And you really see people thinking about sexual vice or vice in general, but sexual vice in particular as a problem that sort of inheres in groups and that inheres in spaces and thus is a collective problem. You know, it's no longer a sort of sin of the soul or sort of an individualized problem. It's something that that could affect anyone who enters a particular space or has a particular, you know, inhabits a particular environment. And so you see cities, municipal governments, for example, trying to target environments for reform rather than people. So you see parts of the city, north and west end of Boston, for example, getting policed more heavily. I mean, this is also the early, like the moment of the sort of institutionalization or municipalization of policing, right? So police forces went from, you know, Simone Brown is excellent on this, so she knows way more about it than me. But you see police forces going from things that are kind of ad hoc to things that are formalized and sort of embedded in city infrastructure. And so I'm kind of thinking about that. But yeah, you're right. Like, so I go from that, which I'm thinking about the shift from the individual understanding of like sex of sexual behavior as a problem to a kind of collective understanding of sexual behavior as kind of a collective problem that could be targeted not only in people or not even exclusively or best in people, but in environments, to thinking in the epilogue just about the sort of the sort of biopolitics of sexuality and the way that the management of sexuality becomes and sexual behavior becomes a sort of key term and key strategy for other types of governance. And, you know, one of the things that I kind of end up, the epilogue, it's funny, I wrote the epilogue really, I mean, the first half of the epilogue, which is all about Malthus and theories of population, I wrote very slowly over time. The second half of the epilogue I wrote in like 3 days, thinking that I would just, you know, revise it later when I got to copy edits. And then when I got to copy edits, I was sick of working on the book, and B, I was kind of like, you know what? I wrote a really weird epilogue. I'm just going to leave it and see what happens. You know, I revised it, but I just sort of like left the weird ideas there. So, you know, there's a long like sort of discussion of like the relationship between natural history and like early queer theory, for example. I think I end the book just trying to think about the sort of perils of individuation, like the problem,
right?
The problems that appear in thinking about sexuality in this kind of individuated way, and the sort of challenges, some of which are fairly difficult to surmount, I think, that sort of brings to fomenting and sustaining a politics, like a politics that's not just about like gay freedom. You know what I mean? It's not just about like making right. sure the HRC mm-hmm. has a lot of money so gay people can join the military and get married, which in my opinion are like two of the worst possible objectives for queer politics ever. But you know, the, but like that, you know, that can think in broadly structural ways about, you know, justice and liberation that, you know, like, and what queer politics are, which are like, yeah, there's stories about sexual freedoms that I absolutely want in there. But like, you know, I also want stories, you know, I want queer politics to be about, you know, reproductive justice, about anti-racism, about, you know, toppling like hierarchies that are sort of shot through and dependent on white supremacy. So, I mean, and I think that individuation right now, it's something I wrestle with in my teaching and in my writing. Yeah, that's kind of where I end the book. But it's funny because like, I guess individuation is, you know, the move away from individuation into the sort of modernity of sexuality, you know, the onset of sexology, as I sort of argue in the fifth chapter. I mean, that's kind of the problem. There's a lot that's also foreclosed by the move to the sort of collective.
Right. I thought it was particularly interesting, and correct me if I misunderstood you, but I thought it was interesting when you talk about the perils of the individuated sort of biopolitical hermetic yeah. body. And how you sort of describe how the focus on this category and the study of sexuality through this category, and sexuality and race actually through this category, has sent these two types of inquiry and theorizations, that is theorization on race and ethnicity and theorization on gender and sexuality, into sort of parallel conversations for a long time. I thought that was a really interesting point to bring out, and sort of really generative, especially when thinking about, like I mentioned at the beginning, denaturalizing the present and thinking about how the study of the deeper past, longer past, can help us formulate different futures. I thought that was extremely promising and useful.
Yeah, so I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Oh yeah, I do think that there's a way that looking at long histories, like long durée histories, allows us to see things that were, that maybe don't exist or don't exist in the same way anymore, that might be instructive for our own moment. You know, like I think like there's a way, and I think I'd also say this in the epilogue or maybe just in the intro, that like there's a way in these 18th century texts that I look at that it's hard to tell what we would today call race and sexuality apart from one another. And to me, that really seems like it points to a sort of shared set of interests or shared set of fortunes around sort of like morphological, behavioral, mm-hmm. Et cetera, like difference or variation, you know, like a shared set of sort of fortunes that I think that could be really instructive for us today. I mean, I think part of me, you know, I wrote that epilogue as a jaded queer person who has just like been so disappointed by, so, I mean, I also, you know, we're having this conversation on like the eve of like the most corporate pride that I've experienced in my entire life, where like every ad is like smeared right. with rainbow flags, and you know what I mean? I'm like, since when did Adidas give a shit about gay people? You know, and it just makes me sad because I'm like, oh, so now gayness, like I think we're in a real moment where we see the way that like queerness really can have absolutely nothing to do with, like, it's really possible to be gay and not give a shit about other people, you know, like, and not really care about some of the most striking forms of violence that are sort of and iniquity that are sort of structuring the world around us. And I think anyway, that very sort of ugly place is where I wrote that epilogue from. And I think that like the less individuated we can think, you know, the more connected I think we'll understand ourselves in relation to each other. And I think that trying to expose the roots of the way that like individuation or kind of epistemologies of individuation have also sort of pulled different types of like movements for justice or movements against oppression away from each other. I think, yeah, I don't know. I guess I hoped that would be interesting to people. It sounds like at least it was interesting to you, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, it was to me for sure. So Greta, thank you very much for your time. Just before we go, I'd just like to ask if there's anything else we didn't discuss that you'd like to mention. And what else are you working on at the moment?
I don't think there's anything else we didn't discuss. And what I'm working on right now, I'm working on two projects, book projects, one of which is, the one I'm working on more is tentatively called, I've used both titles, but either A Queer History of Sexual Violence or A Feminist History of Sexual Violence. And it's kind of inspired by the work that I didn't do in this first book. One of the things that you see, feminist historians in particular do, and, you see a lot of, historians of sexuality that don't treat sexual violence. And they'll do this from a sort of ethical standpoint. You know, they'll say like, you know, I'm talking about bestiality, I'm talking about masturbation, I'm talking about adultery, fornication, sodomy, whatever, but I'm not going to talk about sexual violence because sexual violence isn't sex. There's something that about sexual violence that makes it not proper to the sort of realm of sexuality. But of course, you know, before, at least in the United States, the sort of advent of marital rape laws, I mean, if at all, you know, sex and violence and sex and sexuality and sexual violence, there was really no functional difference between the two, you know, and I think that if you don't write about the history of sexual violence relative to the history of sexuality, you also cut like huge, huge, huge populations of people out of the story of the history of sexuality. I'm thinking especially of Black women, but not exclusively Black women. So the book is kind of thinking about, how it's a kind of, I'm thinking of it as an episodic history, and it's a history that goes from the late 18th to the late 20th century. I keep saying that, you know, everyone else gets to write a weird second book, so I'm going to write a weird second book too. so that tries to think about like feminist negotiations, with the sort of problem of sexual violence, and how those negotiations, legal, extra-legal, cultural, et cetera, have sort of influenced what we understand sexuality to be or not be. And in a way, the book was really inspired by, I feel like this might be like one of the weirdest things that anyone's ever said about Hilton Ells, but it was inspired by the first essay in Hilton Ells's book, White Girls, which is called Truth or Peak, which I think is just one of the most like masterful essays I've ever read. But he's kind of thinking about the term that we now think of as like white feminism. He describes that position as white girl. And you know, in that book, for anyone who's familiar with it, there's all sorts of white girls, and white girls don't neither have to be white nor girls. So like, you know, Eminem is a white girl. I'm trying to think, Michael Jackson's a white girl. There's all different white girls. And he really thinks of the white girl as like this position, in the sort of economy of, in the sort of social economy of desire that's both vulnerable, because it's sort of sought after, there's a sort of sexuality to it that's sought after and sort of chased, and, it's sort of like, it's both vulnerable, but it's also a position that really understands how to weaponize that vulnerability. And I read that essay, I was just so blown away by it. And I've just been thinking a lot ever since I read it, and also before, about the phrase white feminism, because A, we use it now, and I think it really names something real, you know, but it also, I think there's a kind of flatness to it, because people, like, I'll hear my students say like, oh, like, you know, the second wave feminism was white feminism. I'm like, oh my God, like there's nothing that feels more offensive to me than thinking about like, I don't know, like all the really important like anti-prison work that a lot of feminists were doing in that moment, and just like collapsing that into white feminism. You know what I mean? Like, right, you know, I'm like, there was some real serious anti-racist work of that era. You know, Audre Lorde is that era. But anyway, so, but and weirdly, the book is kind of a genealogy, this new book I'm working on, of white feminism. And it's kind of thinking about how the recognition, how sexual vulnerability was sort of manufactured and asserted and came to adhere to specific groups of women, usually white women, not always upper class women, but often upper class women, and how that sort of whiteness, that combination of like whiteness and sexual vulnerability, was something that could later be weaponized towards sort of racist ends. There's like a sort of story in the book about the history of whiteness alongside the sort of history of feminism and the history of sexuality. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of in an early moment with it right now, but that's what I'm working on.
Well, that sounds super interesting, and let all the weirdness come out, please.
I'm going to. No bug. Oh, I'm so sorry about that.
Greta, thanks for talking to us today, and good luck with your book.
Thank you so much.